TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Robert Fisk, The Fantasy War, Liberation, Weapons of Mass Destruction, and Democracy. This is the second half of a two-part talk about Iraq after the war by the renowned British journalist Robert Fisk. Directly from Baghdad via Jordan, he came to the Bay Area in mid-October 2003. He had chosen the title The Fantasy War because of the tragic and bizarre discrepancy between Iraq's reality and the reporting in the U.S. media, and between the rhetoric of the U.S. administration and the facts on the ground. Few people are as qualified as Robert Fisk to talk to this issue. His careful attention to detail, his courage before power, and his knowledge of the history of the region have won him many awards. He has lived in the Middle East for over 25 years and has connections and a personal style of reporting that give his words authenticity. There are film mates by the BBC that show him at work, while many of his colleagues stay in hotels and go to press conferences. He's out in the field day after day, often at great personal risk. Now you will hear how the British Foreign Office tried to put pressure on Fisk's editor to suppress reporting about atrocities committed by Saddam Hussein. Here is Robert Fisk on the two-decade-long friendship between Saddam Hussein and the U.S. administration, and yes, also the British government.
A few thoughts on this most recent Iraq war. The horrific Saddam lied to us. The American administration lied to us. And yes, the British government lied to us. We've always been pretty good at spotting Saddam's lies and deceit and mendacity and cruelty. We were reporting his mass killings from the late 70s, when the US government didn't want anything but good relations with the Iraqi regime. I recall one awful day in the early 80s when I was traveling from the Iraq-Iran war front back to Tehran on an Iranian military hospital train. All the soldiers aboard had been gassed. They sat, those Iranians, all victims of Saddam, coughing and choking up blood and mucus into towels. Back in London, I was working for the London Times at the time. My paper front-paged my story of the death train and spoke of war crimes by the Iraqis. And later that week, a British Foreign Office official told my then editor over lunch that Robert Fisk's story has not been very helpful, because, of course, Britain was supporting Saddam against the Iranians, and America, the United States, was supporting Saddam against the Iranians. And that same week that I was on the hospital train, the United States sent a special delegate to meet Saddam Hussein in Baghdad to reopen the American embassy, and as we all know, his name was Donald Rumsfeld. And throughout all those early years, as you also know, we went on supporting Saddam's despicable regime. He was our man against Iran. US trade delegations would participate in a trade fair in Baghdad. I was there when US military delegations sent weapons salesmen to the military trade fair at Muthana Airport. When an Iraqi aircraft fired a missile at the American frigate USS Stark in the Gulf in 1987, almost sinking the vessel, Washington sent a high-level naval delegation to Baghdad to share in a joint inquiry with Saddam's men. The Pentagon then charitably concluded that the Iraqi attack had been a mistake, that the pilot had thought he was firing at an Iranian ship, and, so they supposed, because the pilot was not allowed to talk to them, the pilot had already been executed on Saddam's orders. Last week, I met that pilot's colleagues in Baghdad, along with one of the most senior Air Force officers in the Iraqi Air Force. The pilot who attacked the USS Stark was never executed. He lives today in Baghdad. He didn't know he was firing at an American ship, but he had orders to attack any vessel in a so-called forbidden zone off the Iraqi coast. The Americans, I was told by these pilots, had been warned not to enter this zone, but the Stark did so. Afterwards, they said, Washington obeyed the Iraqi rules. No more American ships ever entered Saddam's forbidden zone. And all this time, of course, the Pentagon and the CIA knew that Saddam was using gas, knew that his intelligence men were torturing prisoners, knew that Saddam's opponents were tipped into mass graves, knew about the raping rooms, and knew that political prisoners were whipped to death with electric cables as they lay in sewers in Saddam's Baghdad intelligence headquarters. That was the nature of the US relationship with Saddam. We, Britain as well, supported this terrible regime, no worse than some others in the world, you might say, but wicked enough. He was our friend, and his greatest friend was us. And be in no mistake about what this reality meant in Iraq. For when Saddam's regime fell, we journalists came across the proof, not just in the execution rooms and the opened mass graves, but in a terrifying series of videotapes taken by Saddam's own secret policemen, showing the torture by whipping of countless political prisoners, most of them Shiite Muslims, many of them having participated in the 1991 rebellion, which we encouraged them to stage, George Bush Sr. in particular. And then we left them, as you know, to Saddam's mercy. We found hours of this material, vile and obscene, frightening, vicious. But because I believe in what I call the Department of Home Truths, I'm going to show you a very, very short sequence now from a videotape made in Baghdad by the Iraqi Mukhabarat Intelligence Service. The cameraman was an Iraqi Secret Service officer. It was taken later in the 1990s as prisoners were whipped and beaten with cables on the orders of a senior intelligence officer. Now remember that these were officers to whom we gave intelligence information in their war against Iran, against the Shiite neighbors of the poor men you will now see. I should say that though brief, these scenes which you will see are shocking. They have not been seen in America before. There's something that you will only have familiar with, I think, in the most violent of Hollywood movies. Secret policemen savagely beat a prisoner, and a group of terribly mutilated inmates are then herded back to their cells. This is real life, however, not Hollywood. And if you want to close your eyes for the next minute and a half, I'll understand, because I've already done that. We can have the first tape and the lights down. Ladies and gentlemen, the enormity of what you have just seen can be judged by the fact that the whole tape, which I hope you will never see, lasts for more than 45 minutes. And this was a scene being enacted out through all the long years of our friendship for Saddam. Who were these films made for? Who was supposed to watch them? Uday and Qusay Saddam, the sons of the great man, Hussein. Saddam himself, or the victims themselves, or the victims' families. It was part of the system of the Ba'athist regime that the people should know that this happened. Thus they would know what would happen to them. It was not rumor, the Iraqis were informed. Look at this. Did you notice there were spectators in military uniform at the back in one sequence? Ba'ath party officials watching those terrible scenes, perhaps. Were the tapes made for them? And where were they watched? In a palace? Coffee? Cakes, perhaps? So for 20 years, we loved this man. But now we claim, 20 years too late, that we came to rescue these people. We came to liberate them, you see, and to discover what, of course, we had known 2 decades ago when he was our friend, that our Saddam was a monster all along. And now we have liberated the Iraqis We expect them to buy our version of history. Maybe now there's a reality check. In the Pentagon, they've been re-showing Guillo Pontecorvo's terrifying 1965 film of the French War in Algeria. The Battle of Algiers, La Bataille d'Alger, in black and white, showed what happened to both the guerrillas of the FLN and the French army when their war turned dirty. Torture, assassination, booby-trap bombs, secret executions. The flyers sent out by the Pentagon brass to watch this magnificent, painful film began with the words, "How to win a battle against terrorism and lose the war of ideas." But the Americans didn't need to watch the Battle of Algiers. They've already committed many of the French mistakes in Iraq, and the guerrillas of Iraq are well into the blood tide of the old FLN. 16 demonstrators killed in Fallujah? Forget it. 12 gunned down by the Americans in Mosul? Old news. 10 Iraqi policemen shot by US troops outside Fallujah? No information, the occupation authorities told us last month. No information? The Jordanian embassy bombing? The bombing of the UN headquarters? Or Najaf with its 126 dead? Forget it. Things, according to Donald Rumsfeld today, are improving in Iraq. Only one US soldier dead yesterday. Only three the day before. Things are getting better. That's how the French used to report the news from Algeria. What you don't know doesn't worry you, which is why in Iraq there are thousands of incidents of violence that never get reported. Attacks on Americans that cost civilian lives are not even recorded by the occupation authority press officers unless they involve loss of life among coalition forces. Our deaths matter, right? Their deaths don't. Go to the mortuaries, as I say, of Iraq's cities, and it's clear that a slaughter occurs each night. Occupation powers insist now that journalists obtain clearance to visit hospitals. It can take a week to get the right papers, if at all. So goodbye to statistics, you see. They don't want us there, do they? But the figures coming from senior doctors tell their own story. I get into hospitals now through a back gate or a small bribe or with the help of the doctors. In Baghdad, up to 70 corpses of Iraqis killed by gunfire are brought to the mortuaries every two or three days. In Najaf, for example, this is a small city, the cemetery authorities have recorded the arrival of the bodies of up to 20 victims of violence a day. Some of the dead were killed in family feuds, in looting, or others' killings. Others have been gunned down by US troops at checkpoints, or in the increasingly vicious raids carried out by American forces in the suburbs of Baghdad and the Sunni cities to the north and west. Reporters covering the killing of the Fallujah policemen, 8 of them, were astonished to see badly wounded children suddenly arriving at the same hospital as the police wounded, shot, according to their families, by an American tank which had opened fire at a palm grove outside the town. The BBC filmed the tank, but ran away when it turned its muzzle on them. As usual, the occupation authorities had no information on the incident. But if you count the Najaf dead as typical of just two or three other major cities, and if you add on the daily Baghdad death toll and multiply by 7, and then by 4, and then by the 7 months since we liberated the Iraqis, perhaps 1,000 Iraqi civilians are being killed every week. And that may well be a conservative figure. Somewhere in the cavernous marble halls of proconsul Paul Bremer's palace on the Tigris, someone must be calculating these awful statistics. But of course the Americans are not telling us. It's like listening to Iraq's American-run radio station, Death, unless it's on a spectacular scale, like the Jordanian or UN or Najaf bombings, simply doesn't get on the air. Even the killing of American servicemen isn't reported for 24 hours. Driving the highways of Iraq, I've been reduced to listening to the only radio station with up-to-date news on the guerrilla war in Iraq, Iran's Alam Radio, broadcasting in Arabic from Tehran. It's as if the denizens of Mr. Bremer's chandeliered chambers do not regard Iraq as a real country, a place of tragedy and despair, whose liberated people increasingly blame their liberators for their misery. Even when US troops, on a raid in Mansour 2 months ago, gunned down up to 8 civilians, including a 14-year-old boy, the best the Americans could do was to say that they were inquiring into the incident. Not, as one US colonel quickly reminded us, that this meant a formal inquiry. Oh no, just a few questions here and there. And of course, the killings were quickly forgotten. What is happening inside the US occupation army is almost as much a mystery as the nightly cull of civilians. My old friend Tom Friedman, in a break from his messianic commentaries for the New York Times, put his finger on the problem when, arranging a meeting with an occupation official, he reported asking an American soldier at a bridge checkpoint for his location. The enemy side of the bridge, the soldier said. Enemy. That's how the French came to see every native Algerian. Talk to the soldiers in the streets in Baghdad, and they use obscene language about the Iraqis, in between heartfelt demands and understandable demands to go home. This is about the people they were supposed to be rescuing from Saddam Hussein. A Polish journalist in Kerbala saw just how easily human contact can break down between occupied and occupier. I'll quote from his report. The American guards are greeting passers-by with a loud salam alaikum. Some young Iraqi boys with a donkey and cart say something in Arabic, and suddenly together they run their fingers across their throats. Motherfucker, shouts the Marines, before their translator quietly explains to them that the boys are just expressing their happiness at the death of Saddam Hussein's sons. Though light years from the atrocities of Saddam's security forces, the US military is turning out to be as badly disciplined and brutal as the Israeli army in the West Bank and Gaza. I learned the other day that they have been given copies of the Israeli army's rules of engagement in civilian areas. The American army's recon by fire, its lethal raids into civilian homes, its shooting of demonstrators and children during firefights, its destruction of houses, its imprisonment of thousands of Iraqis without trial or contact with their families, its refusal to investigate killings, its harassment and killing of journalists, its constant refrain that it has no information about bloody incidents, which it must know all too much about, as sounding like an echo chamber of the Israeli army in the occupied territories. Worse still, American intelligence information is still as warped by ideology as was the illegal Anglo-American invasion of Iraq. Having failed to receive the welcome deserved of liberators, the Americans have to convince themselves that their tormentors, save for the famous Saddam remnants, cannot be Iraqis at all. They must be members of Al-Qaeda, Islamists arriving from Iran, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, Pakistan. Interestingly, when I was in the police station at Fallujah 2 weeks ago, a captain in the 82nd Airborne referred to the attackers as Syrian-backed terrorists and local freedom fighters. Something wrong there. The video screen got, you know, this does not compute, of total disk failure, right? What he meant, of course, was that he couldn't call the Iraqis terrorists, otherwise the policemen he has to work with would leave the Americans on their own in the police station. So they're being nice to the Iraqis, the Iraqi terrorists, right? But you can attack Syria, no problem there at all. Among its 1,000 security prisoners at Baghdad Airport, the total number of detainees held without trial in Iraq is now about 6,500. About 200 are said to be foreigners. But in many cases, US intelligence cannot even discover their nationality. And many of them may well have been in Iraq since Saddam invited Arabs to defend Baghdad before the invasion. In reality, no one has produced a shred of evidence publicly that Al-Qaeda men are streaming into the country, as Rumsfeld and Bush claim. Not a single sighting has been reported of these mysterious men, save for the presence of armed guards outside the shrines of Najaf after the bombing, who couldn't speak Arabic but spoke Persian. They're Iranians, of course. Yet President Bush and Rumsfeld have talked up their supposed presence of these foreigners to the point where your usual right-wing commentators and then reporters in general write of them as a proven fact. It's a powerful irony, you know. Osama bin Laden's ominous September 11th message suggests that he is as anxious to get his men into Iraq as your government is as anxious that you should believe they're already there. Something odd there, some kind of connivance, isn't there? In practice, you see, fantasy takes over from reality. Thus, while the United States can claim they are being assaulted by foreigners, the infamous men of evil, you see, they can equally suggest that the suicide bombing of the UN headquarters in Baghdad, in which DeMeo died, was the work of the Iraqi security guards whom the UN had kept on from the Saddam regime. Whatever the truth of this, and the suicidal expertise of the UN attack might mean both Baathists and Islamists, the message was simple enough. Americans, you see, are attacked by international terrorists, But the wimps of the UN are attacked by the same Iraqi killers they helped to protect through so many years of sanctions busting. Poor old UN. There are foreign men and women in Baghdad, aplenty, Americans and Britons prominent among them, who work hard to bring about the false promises uttered by Bush and Blair to create a decent, democratic Iraqi society. One of them is Chris Wolford, whose account of life in Bremer's Marble Palace appeared only in a tiny English newspaper, that of the Oftel Mobile Phone Regulatory Agency in South London. He wrote a little newsletter home to say what life was like. It was highly revealing. I'm going to read you part of it now. Life in Baghdad can only be described as bizarre. We are based within a huge compound in Saddam Hussein's former presidential palace. The place is awash with vast marble ballrooms, conference rooms, now used as a dining room, a chapel with murals of Scud missiles, and hundreds of function rooms with ornate chandeliers, which were probably great for entertaining, but which function less well as offices and dormitories. I work in the ministry's wing of the palace. Behind each door, military and civilian coalition members, mainly American, with the odd Brit dotted about, we're very odd, aren't we, are beavering away trying to sort out the economic, social and political issues currently facing Iraq. The work is undoubtedly for a good cause, but it cannot but help feel strange as our contact with the outside world, the real Iraq, is so limited. Key decisions are still very much taken behind the closed doors of the Coalition Provisional Authority, or for the most significant decisions back in Washington, D.C. Ouch. So much then for the interim council and the appointed Iraqi government that supposedly represents the forthcoming democracy of Iraq. Thus are America and Britain attempting to reconstruct a broken land that is now the scene of an increasingly cruel guerrilla war. But there's a pervading feeling among Iraqis as well as journalists covering this country that something is wrong with our Western response to new Iraq. There was an article in the New York Times just a month ago that talked about the terrible toll of human life in Iraq during the summer months. Only when I got to paragraph 5 did I find it was the terrible toll of 86 American lives to which the article referred. What is becoming apparent is that we don't really care about the Iraqis. We may think we want to bring them democracy, but on an individual level, we don't care very much about them or their lives. We liberated them. They should be grateful to us. If they die now, well, so who said democracy was easy? Donald Rumsfeld, who raged away about weapons of mass destruction before the invasion, Saddam's old mate, right, now admits he didn't even discuss weapons of mass destruction with David Kaye, the head of the US team looking for these mythical weapons, on a recent visit to Baghdad. He meets the guy who's looking for the WMDs and says, didn't chat to him about it. Of course not, because he knew what Kaye would report and has reported. There are none. Mr. Rumsfeld, of course, is equally silent about the civilian death toll in Baghdad. It's the followers of his nemesis bin Laden that now have to be publicised. Bin Laden must be grateful. So must the Palestinians. In the refugee camps of Lebanon last month, they were talking to me of the events in Iraq as a form of encouragement. One of them said to me, if Israel's superpower ally can be humbled by Arabs, why should we give up our struggle against the Israelis, who cannot be as efficient soldiers as the Americans? That's the lesson the Algerians drew when they saw France's mighty army reduced to surrender at Dien Bien Phu. The French, like the Americans, had succeeded in murdering or liquidating many of the Algerians who might have negotiated a ceasefire with them. The search for an interlocuteur valable was one of de Gaulle's most difficult tasks when he decided to leave Algeria. But what will the Americans do? Their interlocuteur valable might have been the United Nations. But now the UN has been struck off as a negotiator by the suicide bombing in Baghdad. And the bin Ladens and the adherents of the Wahhabi sect are not interested in negotiations of any kind. Mr. Bush declared war without end, and it looks as though Iraqis, along with ourselves, are going to be its principal victims. I want to make a connection here with September 11, 2001, the International Crimes Against Humanity in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania. We, through our alliances, through our military involvement in the Middle East, through our failure to act in the face of decades of brutality, have created real enemies in the Middle East. In Iraq, we are doing the same now. In Iraq, the suicide bomber has joined America's enemies, just as he did in Lebanon. We lied about Lebanon. We said we were coming to save the Palestinians. In Bosnia, we eventually intervened, far too late again, to save the Muslims. In Iraq, we intervened 2 decades too late to save the Iraqis, we said. Weapons of mass destruction indeed, democracy indeed, liberation indeed. The other day, I bought at auction in Britain a poster put up on the streets of Baghdad in 1917 by the British Army that had just invaded Iraq. Signed by General Sir Stanley Maud and addressed to the people of Baghdad almost 100 years ago, remember, it began with these words: "To the people of the Vilaya, the governorate of Baghdad, we come here not as conquerors, but as liberators, to free you from generations of tyranny." Sound familiar to you? Within 3 years, the British Army was fighting a bloody guerrilla war against the Iraqis. 400 of the British dead now lie, to this day, in the North Wall Cemetery in Baghdad. In the end, with the encouragement of Winston Churchill, we even used poison gas against the Kurds. But at this point, I fear both the parallels and the lessons are probably too painful to continue. So for your patience tonight, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much.
That was the second half of a two-part speech by the award-winning British journalist, author, and filmmaker Robert Fisk. He spoke in October 2003 in Berkeley, California. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Robert Fisk on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a one-hour copy of the complete talk by Robert Fisk on the Fantasy War by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.